Hey, everybody, it's Devin.
No. Try again. Hey, everybody, it's Devin.
And Kate.
Welcome to Med Crimes. So, we have big news.
Do we?
This is episode 50.
Oh, hell yeah. That is huge news.
Milestone.
Hashtag bicentennial? Is that the term? Bicentennial episode?
No, isn't that 200?
Yep.
Because you're centennial.
Bye. I'm leaving. Sorry. Oh, we love you guys.
We're at a half a centennial.
We are.
We've had a week, and I have vacation brain. I'm on the vacation brain. I'm looking forward to Saturday. Really, yeah. I'm looking forward to tomorrow at 4 o'clock, let's be honest. But so by the time you all hear this, I will be in Santa's Village. Whoop whoop.
Oh, we love Santa's Village. If any of you guys have not gone, it's in is it like mid-northern New Hampshire?
Oh, it's north.
It's like far north for us because we're like sort of more south, but
the bottom corner.
Yeah, I mean, if you're like in the New England area and you're thinking about taking a trip, please do it. And you have kids, oh my God, it is phenomenal. The kids love it. It's all they talk about. We're going to in a couple of weeks.
We're looking forward to it.
It's going to be great.
Memories that last a lifetime. So I was just saying to you earlier, I was like, holy crap, I can't believe I have the honors of episode 50.
Dude, it's special because it's a two-parter Devinism.
It's Devin's first, second part.
Yes, it's a special episode because we've been talking about doing this episode for quite a while. And obviously
we
Devin
have
is
since
doing
the beginning.
Like a phenomenal job with it. So it's one that has been sort of more highly anticipated, at least by me. I don't know. I can't talk for
we've
everybody
been
else.
Since the beginning, and we were talking about story headlines, and we were like, oh my God, we should talk about lobotomies.
Since the beginning of time.
We are also getting close and slowly wrapping around our second year of Med Crimes.
Oh my gosh, we are so close.
What is going on? I don't know, but time is flying. Time is flying. We said podcasts were for the long haul, right?
We are literally in it, and I cannot tell you how much I wish that we could do this a lot more often. Like, I really, we get messages a lot about, like, you know, we wish we could get more from you guys. We understand how busy we are.
We wish to.
Believe me, this is, like, kind of a highlight of our time when we get to, like, sit together and, like, record episodes and get to research all this stuff and pick, like, cool new cases and talk with you guys on all the social media. And it's, like, a really, really fun part of our lives, and it's like a really nice sort of distraction from the day-to-day to us. We just want to let you know how much we appreciate you guys, and
we love that you want more of us. We wish we could give it to you, but I feel like if we did more, it would become more of a burden than something that we look forward to.
Yeah, exactly. It would just, you know, with both of us being moms and working full time, it's kind of like time-wise, it's just we wish we had the extra time to put into it, but maybe in the future, you never know.
Maybe in the future, time will tell. Keep loving on us, and maybe we'll give the people what they want.
Yeah, the more happy messages we get, you know, the brighter and happier we get. So
before we start getting rolling into episode 50, we have two new Patreons to announce to our family.
Yeah, we do. And they are pretty awesome.
Welcome to the family, Alyssa Thomas. Thanks for joining us.
Alyssa Thomas, we know you personally and you're really awesome.
And then we have Brooke Tonione. And I'm so sorry if I mispronounced that. Tonione? Tonione.
I love that.
Isn't it fabulous? These names,
it's Brooke,
you guys.
It's Brooke with a bit of mystery.
Brooke with a bit of mystery. And you guys, you know what you guys are? So have you ever seen Neverending Story? You know,
oh my God, are they the big white dog?
They're Felcor, the big white. They're like the big white, like monster
dog looking
thing.
Dude.
Yes, they're Felcors. You guys are fabulous, and you fly, and you're huge, and you're like wise somehow, and you're just fantastical. That's what you guys are. You're Felcor. We love you, Felcor.
Never ending story. That is very 80s.
Oh my god, I know. I know.
Maybe 90s, but still. Yep. Anyway.
Yep.
I think we've spent enough time saying hi.
Never enough time.
In part two, we are going to really get into the lobotomy and how it was really formalized and really became popular, and the two physicians that were behind it. If you really want to know the backstory and the history as to why, you should listen to part one.
Yes,
because
do.
it really gets pretty detailed into the history of what the asylums looked like and kind of how mental health treatments have evolved.
The nice part, too, about part one is that it really goes through, like, a timeline, because it's hard, unless you really know, like, what's happening at any given sort of group of years, it's hard to, you know, really picture how this is going. So the timeline was really clearly laid out in episode one. That was really helpful.
Yes. Yes. So in starting this episode, we had kind of stopped last time after I briefly described what the lobotomy is. Mm. So I'm just going to briefly describe what it is again to kick us off, and we're going to get into it. So, the lobotomy, which was also originally called the leuconomy, is a form of neurosurgical treatment for psychiatric disorder or neurological disorders that involves severing the connections in the brain's prefrontal cortex. The surgery causes most of the connections to and from the prefrontal cortex, the anterior of the frontal lobes of the brain, to be severed. This consisted of cutting the connections to and from the prefrontal cortex of the brain, and it's the region that is responsible for our everyday decisions, language, memory, socializing, spontaneity. It's basically the part of the brain that makes us who we are.
Your literal soul. Your literal yep. soul.
And actually, that comes up again in a little bit later, too. I briefly mentioned, I think, if I'm trying to go off my memory when I was putting it together, I think they call it the surgery of the soul.
Oh, they do. Interesting.
I feel like they call it the surgery of the soul because they're essentially taking it away. Taking
well,
away
like
of who
the
we
saddest.
Are.
That's like the saddest. That's just so incredibly sad that this like happened. Ugh. I hate it. Anyway.
So getting into how the heck this occurred, a Portuguese physician. Now, give me a minute. I'm going to try to abbreviate pronounce his name.
You got
Antonio Egas Moniz. He was a Portuguese neurologist, and he was the developer of the cerebral angiography. Did I pronounce that right?
Angiography.
You corrected me in part one. That's why I was like pausing like, Kate, did I say that right? So cerebral angiography is a form of angiography which provides images of the blood vessels in and around the brain, which then allow you to detect the abnormalities such as different malformations and aneurysms.
Mm-hmm.
Did I get that correct?
You sure did. Yeah.
Thanks, doc.
Nailed it. Not a doc. Nailed it, though.
Thanks, NP.
Thank you.
Antonio, he is regarded as one of the founders of the modern psychosurgery. He developed it started out as the leuconomy. That's what they called it initially, is the leuconomy. Today it's known as the lobotomy. But he became the first Portuguese national to receive a Nobel Prize for creating the surgery. He won that in 1949.
Really?
It does get a little bit controversial towards his death, but I'll get there in just a moment.
I'm having like flashbacks to like, you know, the movie Shutter Island, and I know we draw a lot of parallels to movies like when we do these episodes.
Mm-hmm.
But
was that Leo DiCaprio?
Easy. Yes, with like
yes.
the very beautiful building, beautiful landscape, but like it was, you know, some kind of fresh hell on the inside, and they
yes.
also did, you know, go into, you know, lobotomies as a mm-hmm. treatment. And so I'm having like Shutter Island moments over here, which is a great movie. I highly recommend it.
So Moniz, he was born in Avanca, Estareja, Portugal.
Ooh.
That's my best pronunciation.
Nailed it.
He attended the College of St. Fidelis and studied medicine at the University of Coimbra, graduating in 1899. That is so far back ago.
That was a long ass time ago.
Yes, he graduated in 1899. And so for that point on, for the next 12 years, he was a lecturer for basic medical courses at the university. In 1911, he became a neurology professor at the University of Lisbon, and that's where he worked until he retired. He retired in 1944. Now, if you remember a little bit, again, in part one, in 1944 is when the president and the government were really getting into, like, okay, we need to get some announcements and more. We need to get more research going into mental health and what we're doing. And that's when they passed the, what was the name of the act? It was like a behavioral health act, to try and get more awareness and research going. So that's at the time that this Portuguese physician had retired.
Cue the cerebral angiography.
Mm-hmm. So Moniz thought that mental illness originated from abnormal neural connections in the frontal lobe. He described a fixation of synapses, which in mental illness was expressed as predominant obsessive ideas.
Okay.
He often in his teachings and in his research referenced experiences of a Yale physiologist, John Fulton Jacobson, who found that removing the frontal lobes of a chimpanzee made it calmer and more cooperative. So, in addition, Moniz had observed changes in character and personality among soldiers who had had injuries to their frontal lobes. So this is how he's kind of like hypothesizing and coming up with this idea, is that he goes, okay, so tests have been done on chimpanzees to make them more calm. And then they're like, well, soldiers who have, you know, essentially TBIs, right? And they've damaged frontal lobes. Well, they've had character changes. So can we do this intentionally to change someone if there's characteristics that they want to change?
That does, you know, in theory, it does make sense.
I'm not completely mad at this guy. The next guy, let me tell you. So the one who took it and ran with it. But anyway, so Moniz had hypothesized that surgically removing white matter fibers from the frontal lobe would improve a patient's mental illness. He got a longtime staff member that worked with him, who was a neurosurgeon, Almeida Lima, to test the procedure on a group of 20 patients. Oh. These patients mainly had schizophrenia, anxiety, and depression, and they did them under general anesthesia. So he's a neurologist. He's not a surgeon. So that's why he got his longtime coworker to kind of be like, hey, I need you to kind of collaborate with me on this.
Now, these are the, like, transcranial lobotomies, correct?
Correct.
We are not talking about the transorbital stuff.
Yeah. Correct. Okay. We are not talking about that yet. So what they are doing is they're essentially screwing holes into the side of the skull to access the brain.
I see.
He enlisted his coworker Almeida Lima to do this procedure on 20 patients. They did it under general anesthesia. The very first one was performed in 1935 on a 63-year-old woman with depression, anxiety, paranoia, hallucinations, and insomnia. So with all of that, good God, that poor woman. I'm just saying. So after the procedure, she experienced a rapid physical recovery, and 2 months later, a psychiatrist noted that she was calmer, less paranoid, and well-oriented. So in the first set of surgeries for the 20 that were tested, so again, it's really like, let's kind of do our mini little case study, again, in the 1935s and the 1930s. I'm sure case study research was not as regulated as now. Not so much. No. On those 20 people, he reported there were 7 cures, 7 improvements, and 6 unchanged cases.
Okay, so, but no bad outcomes in this.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
There were 7 that were like completely cured, 7 that noticed improvements, and 6 that it did nothing to them out of So that was of the 20. So, I mean, for a first little time out, like, not too bad, right?
Yeah.
And he's doing it with a surgeon under general anesthesia. So, not so bad so far.
Sure.
So he never did a surgery himself. Like I said, he enlisted his coworker because he didn't have neurosurgical training. Apparently he also had gout. So he's like, I don't have the use of my hands. So he's like, sure. you gotta be my person.
Fair.
So what they did with these procedures, they injected, what they also did was they were injecting absolute alcohol to help it. So once they screwed into this through the skull, they were injecting absolute alcohol to destroy the frontal lobe. They're almost like burning it, essentially.
Okay. Like ablating the whole thing. Okay.
Right, right. Then they developed that technique where they used also a needle-like instrument that was like a wire loop. And then, so what they would do is by accessing the brain through the skull, they were rotating the wire loop and they were able to surgically separate the white matter fibers.
Oh, wow.
So these are the first like techniques of how he would start it.
Got it.
So like I previously started to say, he first thought his initial results were acceptable in his first 40 or so patients. He was claiming prefrontal lobotomy is a simple operation, always safe, which may prove to be an effective surgical treatment in certain cases of mental disorder. He also claimed that any behavioral and personality deterioration may occur was outweighed by reduction in the debilitating effects. So they're like, okay, well, anything that might happen is certainly going to be better than what you're currently experiencing.
Yeah, that's what it seems like with...
That to me is like, well, also that's might also just be partial, you know, that's mm-hmm. a little biased maybe, but so let's see. He did state that the patients who had deteriorated significantly from the mental illness did not benefit much. So it was definitely better in the earlier stages, a little bit younger ages. And then, so like I said, in 1949, he did receive the Nobel Prize for his discovery of the therapeutic value of lobotomy in certain psychoses.
Hmm.
So they were like, wow, we finally have someone who's got a little bit of headway onto how to treat these patients.
We have a handful of knowledge and an intervention. Finally.
We do. They're like, sweet, we can go somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
However, critics later accused Moniz of understating his complications and that he was providing inadequate documentation and that he was not also always doing proper follow-ups. So this is where, like, also at this point in time, he was getting criticized, and then also there were some American physicians that started to kind of, like, take it on and really become making a go.
Got it.
So there have been calls to rescind Moniz's Nobel Prize, most specifically from relatives of family members that underwent the lobotomies. Many people, this has been very controversial because given that it was so new, many people were defending him for his scientific contributions, stressing that it was like there is some legacy and legitimacy to the context. However, other people were also saying that he downplayed it and is why he's saying that he shouldn't his legacy shouldn't keep the Nobel Prize. Ironically, unfortunately, in 1939, so this is 5 years before he retired, Dr. Moniz was shot multiple times by a patient who actually had schizophrenia.
Oh, no.
Ironic.
Very.
So at that point, in a wheelchair. He did do some private practice. But then he essentially died from an internal hemorrhage years later in 1955.
Wow.
Yes. Hmm. I wanted to know more about the patient that shot him. However,
yes. Not much to be found.
Not much to be found. But I was like, well, that's ironic.
Yeah, it's too bad.
So he was the physician, the neurologist that really just kind of started brainstorming initial stages of research. And so right around these times, there's some American physicians that are like, I hear what's going on down there. I want to see what we can do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And be like, what can we do over here? How can we take this and roll with it? Here's where we get to the dude.
Oh, the dude.
The dude.
Not the dude.
Walter Freeman. He was born November 14th in 1895 and raised in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. His grandfather was William Keen, and he was a well-known surgeon in the Civil War, which I found fascinating. I was like, okay,
I've always been fascinated by, you know, the medical things that they did on the battlefields and like what they had to do and what their fixes were for things and, you know, how, you know, obviously brutal and horrific, you know, the things that they have seen must have been.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
His father was a successful doctor, so he's kind of coming from this long line of men who were in the medical field and very successful. So this is the path that he was taking. So he attended Yale University in 1912, and he graduated in 1916. Yale!
Good old Yale.
After he graduated, he went on to study neurology at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School. While attending medical school, he studied the work of William Spiller and idolized his groundbreaking work in the new field of neurological sciences. He applied for a coveted position in his hometown of Philadelphia, working alongside his idol, but he was rejected. So unfortunately, his backup plan was in 1924, he went to Washington, D.C. and started practicing as the first neurologist in the city. Not too shabby, if you ask me. When he got to Washington, he began working directly with laboratories at St. Elizabeth's Hospital. Working at the hospital and witnessing the pain and distress suffered by the patients encouraged him to want to do more in this field. He's like, I got to know more about this. I got to do some more. He got his PhD in neuropathology within the few years after and secured a position at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. as the head of the neurology department. So he's doing pretty good for himself.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, again, similar to Moniz, he was a neurologist and not a neurosurgeon. So he enlists the help of neurosurgeon James James Watts. So 1 year after the first leucotomy that happened in Portugal, in 1936... Freeman directed Watts through the very first prefrontal lobotomy in the United States on a housewife named Alice Hood Hammett of Topeka, Kansas.
Okay.
So he was really trying to modify and take on the lobotomy procedure from Moniz, the Portugal physician. And so this is where it got renamed as the lobotomy. So this is where he started going through the doing a prefrontal lobotomy and going through the front instead of going through the sides.
Got it.
So instead of taking corings from the frontal lobes, Freeman's procedure was to sever the connections between the frontal lobes and the thalamus. We're getting really like anatomy here of the brain. Maybe we need to post that in our notes of like, this is where this is. This is where this is. They practiced for a few weeks on cadavers, and then Freeman had performed with Watts the first frontal lobotomy on Alice, like I said. She was suffering from anxiety and depression. At this point, so they did the procedure on her, and then by November, which was 2 months after doing the first lobotomy surgery, Freeman and Watts had already worked on 20 cases. Including several follow-up operations. So they weren't just doing one, they were doing maybe multiple on people. And this is within 2 months. So he's like taking it and rolling with it. He's not wasting any time.
Wow.
And he's like, I want to do this fast. By 1942, the duo had performed over 200 lobotomy procedures and had published results claiming that 63% of the patients had improved. 23% were reported to be unchanged, and 14% were worse after the surgery.
Oh, that's not the best.
When I'm reading those, I'm like, I'm pretty sure the FDA would shut that down.
I'm pretty sure that's not the benchmark. That's not if where you, we want to
be. If you have a 14% negative outcome in your in your clinical trials, I'm pretty sure you're done, right? Because they're not going to keep putting people through.
I kind of feel like no.
Yeah, kind of feel like no.
Yeah.
So he wanted to really simplify this procedure. He's like, how can we take it from what it is and just make it so that it's just like anybody could do it, essentially? Okay. So he really wanted to simplify it, and he wanted psychiatrists to be able to do it. He's like, I want any behavioral health person to be able to do this so that more people could help the exhuming, the large growing number of mentally ill people that are there. So he was hopeful that if they could that they could do this in psychiatric hospitals, even though there were no operating rooms, surgeons, anesthesia, and very limited budgets.
Wow. That is so scary.
Very scary, because if you remember, Moniz, when he was starting his research, they made sure everybody was under general anesthesia. They were doing this in operating rooms when they did their first 20 cases. This guy's like, how can I get a psychiatrist to do it in a psychiatric hospital? You know, just like any Joe Schmo. So this is where he invented the transorbital lobotomy procedure. And this is where I'm like, you see pictures and I'm like, oh my god, ugh.
Yeah, not.
Yeah,
not,
that's all I can say is ugh.
And we will post some pictures and feel free to Google things. But yeah, it's just like the mechanics of it is horrific.
This is essentially taking a device that looks like an ice pick. Mm-hmm. And that's literally on articles that I read. It's called an ice pick to the brain. So it's the transorbital lobotomy. The instrument, instead of calling it an ice pick, was called an orbitoclast. And it was under the eyelid and against the top of the eye socket. So imagine going, I'm feeling my socket right now and going right under your eyelid. Like they're going right over your eyeball. A mallet was then used to drive the orbitoclast through the thin layer of bone and into the brain.
No, I'm good.
His transorbital lobotomy method did not require a neurosurgeon and could be performed outside of the operating room, often by untrained psychiatrists, without the use of anesthesia, by using electroconvulsive therapy to induce a seizure and unconsciousness.
Oh my God.
So can we just picture that for a second? They're going to induce a seizure on you via electricity and make you unconscious. That way, they can do this quick and dirty and fast and do it anywhere and not have to put you under general where you need extra monitoring.
And, I mean, I cannot imagine, I can't even fathom. I mean, you're essentially doing this blind. Like, you're just going into someone's cranium and their brain tissue absolutely blind.
Absolutely.
And, there's no real great landmarking method here because you're just going into a head, a brain cavity. Beep, beep.
With a mallet and a nice pick.
Can you, and I just cannot, I absolutely cannot imagine the horror of this.
Mm-hmm. So basically this procedure now is what played the biggest role in popularizing it. So now he's like, okay, I'm doing this so that it's so simple and so quick that we can just take it on the road. So he was traveling across the United States and he was going into all sorts of different mental institutions. And essentially, he began performing the procedure in his van. And the knockoff is that people were calling this the lobotomobile. Lobotomobile. Let's talk about this word. Lobotomobile.
Okay. The lobotomobile. Okay.
Yes. 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 Not your Batmobile. Your lobotomobile.
I hate this so much. It's just so cringy and awful. And I cannot believe that thousands of people were subjected to this. Anyway,
absolutely.
Continue.
Absolutely. This is why I was saying he's the guy. He's like, how can I take a somewhat okay idea and just steamroll it?
Yeah, I gotta go.
With this Lobotomobile, he at one point during his days, he undertook 25 lobotomies in one single day.
Holy shit.
Mm-hmm. And on average, overall, many of his patients never recovered from the procedures.
Oh my God. How heartbreaking.
So at this point, it's 1950. The longtime partner of Walter Freeman, James Watts, he's like, I'm out. I gotta stop. He left their practice and split due to his opposition to the transorbital lobotomy. He also ended their partnership because he was disgusted by Freeman's modifications of the lobotomy from a surgical operation into a simple office procedure.
So when you say some people didn't recover, you're meaning that, like, either they died of complications or essentially were rendered a complete zombie.
Some died of complications, which I'll get into it a little bit.
Okay.
At least touch upon it. Many were just completely incapacitated. They were left essentially unable to care for themselves. Some of them couldn't speak. Some of them became incontinent. And we'll get there too when I talk about a few cases.
Oh my God.
So this whole procedure, I want you to know, like, so he's going into people's brains and he's doing this start to finish in 10 minutes. He's in, getting out. And that 10 minutes is what he's changing people's lives by damaging the part of the brain that makes them who they are.
And then who the hell knows what else in the brain he's damaging.
Absolutely.
Because he's fucking going in there blind with a crude instrument. Without any imaging guidance or anything.
And so, of course, what he's doing with this is he's advertising the success. And he's posting posters and flyers, all about the flyers.
Ew.
And, you know,
what
and
is
he
it
would,
with the fucking flyers
and
with these
he would,
people?
And he would post side-by-side pictures of people, maybe a gentleman with schizophrenia, and he's looking kind of, you know, bug-eyed and really in distress. And then there'd be a picture of him next to looking normal in a soldier's uniform, you know, what have you.
Probably from years prior or whatever.
This is the way that he's advertising that this is successful. Is look at what they looked like before and here's what they look like now. They
With
were definitely
this miracle 10-minute procedure that can be done in my fucking van. Like a complete freak, like a complete like so sketchy. Oh,
unfortunately, most of the time in the after picture, the person was essentially more of a zombie than a human, like, and he was just taking it as far as like, look, they look so normal. Lies.
So sad.
So despite stories coming out of unsuccessful procedures, he was still gaining popularity. Because just at the mere thought and hope that someone could be better, a loved one could be better than what they are right now, they were still clinging on to the fact that their loved one might be one of the few that improve from it.
And he's you know, victimizing that group of people too, just because right now there's so little that can be done with people that are severely mentally ill or suffering from something so catastrophic like schizophrenia or, you know, major depressive disorder. And these people have literally no hope because there is nothing else.
Nope.
So, you know,
we don't have the antipsychotic meds that we do.
There's nothing. Yeah, there's nothing right now. So they're, you know, oh my God, there's hope. There's like this one little glimmer, this ray of hope that that my loved one could have a chance at a normal life.
So after 4 decades, Freeman had personally performed possibly as many as 4,000 lobotomy surgeries in 23 states, of which 2,500 used his ice pick procedure, despite the fact that he had no formal surgical training. Because like I said in the beginning, he enlisted James Watts. Now, he twisted the procedure around and made it so that a psychiatrist, anybody with no training, could do it. And that's when James is like, this is unsafe. I'm out of here. And so Freeman started really taking over. 1967 was his final surgery on Helen Mortensen. She was a long-term patient and was receiving her third lobotomy from Dr. Freeman. Now, first of all, before I continue, like, if this worked, why do you need three of them? First of all, right?
Yep.
Why do you need two? And then why do you need to go on to have the third?
That is a red flag, is all I'm saying.
During this procedure, she died of a cerebral hemorrhage, as did as many as 100 of his other patients. And he was finally banned from performing surgery.
Oh, thank God. Jesus. Many of his 40 years? He did this for
4 decades. My notes say 4 decades, but I know it's looking about 30 years. Because 36, he did it in 1936, a year after Moniz did his first leucotomy. And then his final procedure was in 1967.
Got it.
And so not only did Helen die of a cerebral hemorrhage, but they're estimating as many as 100 of his of other patients died, while performing the procedure.
Wow.
His patients that did survive the procedure often had to be retaught how to eat and use the bathroom. Relapses were common, some never recovered, and about 15% died from the procedure. In 1951, one patient at Iowa's Cherokee Mental Health Institute died when, get this, ready? So this is in 1951. No. This is in 1951, 16 years before his last lobotomy procedure, before he's banned. One patient at the Cherokee Mental Health Institute died when Freeman subtly stopped for a photo during the procedure, and the surgical instrument accidentally penetrated too far into their brain.
Oh my God.
Oh, you want to take a selfie? Here, let me smile for you. Doesn't matter that I have an ice pick in somebody's brain.
Are you freaking kidding me?
I'm not freaking kidding you. This guy is a barbarian.
Oh my, a literal barbarian. You're so right.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Unfortunately, it was a very popular belief that he lost his medical license, but that was not the case. He did have, after he was done performing lobotomies, and let me refresh by saying after he was done, after he was banned, he opened up a private practice in California. Fortunately, today, this surgical procedure is not performed.
Thank God.
Done. Nobody's taken an ice pick under your eye socket and jamming it into your brain soul. And trying to sever your nerves.
Mm-hmm. Good. Oh my God, what an absolutely nightmarish scenario.
Sadly, in many cases, it was believed to be an improvement in the lives of many mentally ill people, as they were now easier for mental institutions or family members to take care of. That's why it became so popular. If they were still at home, they'd become easier to take care of them because they're a zombie. Or they were going to be cured, and then mental institutions wanted them to happen because they'd be easier to take care of.
They'd be docile. Yeah.
Again, as we were going through the history, they were becoming overcrowded, underfunded. There was not enough staff to care for that population. Finally, the lobotomy came under attack from the medical community, and then by the 1970s, several countries had banned the procedure altogether. So he was banned in 1967 from performing the procedure, but then in the 70s, this is where they were like, nope, this is not happening at all. And Russia banned the lobotomy as being inhumane.
Wow.
Yeah. Fun stuff, right?
Crazy.
Crazy. So I want to touch base on just a few cases of lobotomies that were done. One of his patients, one of Dr. Freeman's patients, was Howard Dully, who was 12 years old.
12. No.
He was He was 12 years old and he was forced to have. You ready for this? This is awful.
No,
this is awful.
I'm not. Stop it.
His stepmother insisted that he needed the lobotomy because he was defiant, daydreamed, and even objected to going to bed.
Okay, that's a logical next step.
That's like Disney movie Wicked Stepmother type of thing.
Oh my God.
Yeah. He was taken to several doctors who all concluded that Howard was just normal. He's fine. He's a normal growing boy. But when his stepmother took him to Freeman, he suggested that he undergo a lobotomy.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Freeman wrote in his diary about Howard in November of this year that I explained to Mrs. Dully that the family should consider the possibility of changing Howard's personality by means of transorbital lobotomy. Mrs. Dully said it was up to her husband, that I would have to talk with him and make it stick. In December, Mr. and Mrs. Dully have apparently decided to have Howard operated on. I suggested that they not tell Howard anything about it.
Oh my God.
In January of 1961, following the 12-year-old's lobotomy, I told Howard what I'd done to him and he took it without a quiver. He sits quietly, grinning most of the time and offering nothing. So essentially, this 12-year-old boy, Freeman, is writing in his diaries and his journals that he just took a 12-year-old boy that's full of life and defiant because he's got a personality and he's asserting himself. And now he's just sitting quietly grinning most of the time and offering nothing because he's a darn zombie.
Oh, my God. How heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
It's so sad.
Now, he was not left in a vegetative state. He was just more very flat and as a zombie. And so when he was 56 years old in 2005, he did go on public radio. He went on NPR and he said that he has no memory of the operation and he never had the courage to ask his family about it.
Wow. So he was left, though, able to...
So he is one where it was like, for the stepmother's perspective, he's like, okay, well, not too bad, because he's now sitting quietly, grinning, not causing a ruckus all around my house. So that's best case scenario for these lobotomies.
For her,
For her, not for him. He survived the surgery one, and his behaviors got better. So he probably went under the success category. Forgetting about anything else that they ever, you know, that they took away from him. So he was not left in a vegetative, incapacitated state.
Wow.
However, Anita Welsh, she's one that can sum up the horrors of a lobotomy. She was lobotomized by Dr. Freeman in 1953 due to postnatal depression.
Oh.
Anita's daughter... Yeah. Told NPR that her mother spent most of her life in menstrual institutions. She's convinced that Freeman's lobotomy destroyed her mother's life, and she states, I quote, I personally think that something in Dr. Freeman wanted to be able to conquer people and take away who they were.
Very sad. I mean, but I mean, she's not wrong. You know, why else would he continue with the, you know, rate at which he was incapacitating these people?
Mm-hmm. And so the last case that I want to touch upon in just a little bit more detail, because it's probably one of the most widely known cases of a lobotomy.
Okay.
I'd say most popular, but I mean, that's kind of a weird way to say it. But it's about Rosemary Kennedy. So John F. Kennedy's sister. So her story is as follows. She was born Rosemary Kennedy on September 13th in 1918. She was the third child and the oldest daughter of Joseph and Rose Kennedy. Now, if we know the Kennedys, right? Very prestigious American family.
Yes.
She was slower. So Rosemary was slower to crawl, slower to walk, and to speak than her brothers. She experienced learning difficulties when she reached school age. And despite her apparent intellectual disabilities, she was able to participate in most of the family activities. So they're definitely noticing some things as a child, that she's a lot slower than the others, but at this point, she's not a distraction to the well-known family, right? She kept a diary as a teenager, and she described people that she met and talked about dances and concerts that she attended and a visit to the Roosevelt White House. When her father was appointed U.S. ambassador to Britain in 1938, she even went to London to live and was presented at court along with her mother and her sister Kathleen. So up until this time, 1938, she's 20 years old. She's still doing okay. Been slower, but she's not like I don't want to say outrageous.
She's not like at the point where she needs to, she's not like at the point where she needs to be institutionalized because she's having all of these like behaviors that aren't manageable or whatnot. Yeah.
Correct. So let's see. But when she returned, so when the family came back in the 1940, Rosemary, it's quoted by her sister Eunice, that Rosemary was not making progress, but seemed instead to be going backward. It's quoted, at 22, she was becoming increasingly irritable and difficult. The following year, after being persuaded that a lobotomy would help to calm his daughter and prevent her sometimes violent mood swings, Joseph Kennedy authorized the operation.
Wow.
There was an article that I read, and it was written by Kate Larson. And so it's called Rosemary, the Hidden Kennedy Daughter. And so in this article, she said that she's depicted as a vivacious daughter with a perfect smile who struggled to find her place in a family that prized achievement and success above all else. In her book, she details that for the first time, the chilling events that deprived Rosemary's brain of oxygen during her birth. And this is something I did not know about. I did not know about this. I knew that she had, received a lobotomy and whatnot, and that she was institutionalized after, but I did not know about her birth story. But so when her mother went into labor, this was her third child. The nurse was that was caring for her at the time was reluctant to deliver the baby without a physician on hand, but the baby was coming fast. So even though the nurse had the training, she waited for the doctor's arrival, and even though it was delayed, she demanded that Rose hold her legs together tightly in the hope of delaying the baby's birth. When that failed, she resorted to holding the baby's head and forcing it back into the birth canal for 2 excruciating hours.
What? Nope.
Yeah. Yep.
Nope.
Yep. So she clearly has a TBI from oxygen deprivation.
Like a hypoxic brain injury. For sure. For sure. Oh my God.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So when she became a toddler after this is when her mother, like I had stated already, that she was not like the others. They were bringing her to every dance party, taking her sailing, incorporating her all into the famous Kennedy life. But when she was 22, when they returned from London, she began having tantrums that sometimes turned violent. This was also at the same time that she's starting to attract male attention. And her father, Joe, who was the ambassador, Joe Kennedy, very famous. Mm-hmm. He's like, an unwanted pregnancy in this family could damage all of his boys' political futures.
Yes, of course. Yes.
And so they wanted to not only protect her, but they also wanted to protect the family. So they're like, this Rosemary is essentially, this whole situation is what they quoted, a ticking time bomb.
Mm-hmm.
So Rosemary was brought to Dr. Freeman, our good old friend that we just spent some time talking about.
He is not my friend.
Nope. So she was brought there to see Dr. Freeman by her father and without her mother's knowledge. So her mother was not there when this occurred, and she was never the same. She went and had the 10-minute lobotomy procedure. And she did not end up the same. She was incapacitated. She was unable to care for herself. She essentially became more toddler-like in her speech and in her intellectual capabilities. So the 22-year-old woman was essentially back to the mindset of a toddler. And this is where I quoted in the beginning that the lobotomy was later being labeled the surgery of the soul.
Oh, God.
Isn't that terrifying?
It's it was the fact that it was like labeled the surgery of the soul. Like, should we be doing this though?
Yes.
Should we be doing this?
I've always been fascinated with the Kennedy family, and I've watched lots of different documentaries and, you know, film remakes and all these things. And the mother seeing Rosemary in this state. She was crushed. She was devastated.
Ugh. And of course.
He was never forgiven. He was never forgiven Ugh. For taking her to Dr. Freeman without her knowledge and doing this to his daughter. All in to save face, essentially. And many
to
of
protect
the
family's reputation.
Yes. And so they often said that she was away at school or at a women's institution when she was really in a mental institution. And a lot of the family members didn't know exactly what happened to her for years. It took decades for them to actually understand what happened to their sister. The last thing that I'll close with this case, though, is just a little bit of like a shredding. This was cool. I did not know this. Okay. So her sister Eunice, Eunice Kennedy Shriver, she had a particularly close relationship with her sister Rosemary, and she had great empathy for her and others who had faced similar challenges. So in 1962, Mrs. Shriver started a summer day camp in her own backyard for children and adults with intellectual disabilities, a camp which involved into the Special Olympics, which is obviously now the global competition that involves 1.4 million athletes from 150 countries. Mm-hmm. So I had no idea that that's how the Special Olympics came out. And how that evolved from was in Eunice Kennedy Shriver's backyard. And it was because of her sister who had that. Like, I don't know as if I ever made the connection that that's how the Special Olympics were created. So.
Right. Interesting.
Yes. So that is the story of the lobotomy and what Dr. Freeman and everybody else did to these poor, poor mentally ill people.
It's, you know, the saddest part of this is that this was not that long ago.
No.
Like, in the grand scheme of things, this was, like, literally not that long ago.
70 to 80 years ago. Mm-hmm.
That's wild that this was a chapter.
Freeman wasn't banned till, what did I say, 1967? So, 60 years ago? Mm-hmm.
That's horrifying.
Absolutely horrifying. Thankfully, we've said... We have medications, though there's a lot of controversy around antipsychotic medications, they are a hell of a lot safer than taking an ice pick to someone's brain and then stopping to take a photo while you're doing it.
And maybe less barbaric and dangerous and...
And a hell of a lot more invasive. Less negative outcomes.
Yes, exactly.
Absolutely. Ugh, absolutely. Wow. So thankfully, we've evolved and we're still evolving.
Oh, thankfully. My goodness.
Thankfully.
That was heavy, Devin. You did a great job.
Thank you.
This was an amazing big 5-0.
Big 5-0. I'm glad I'm not personally the 5-0. I'm not ready for that.
I'm not either.
Well, thank you for listening, everybody, on episode 50. If you want to continue finding us, you can follow us on Facebook by searching Med Crimes Podcast.
You can tweet at us at MedCrimesPC, maybe.
You can find us on Instagram by following MedCrimes Podcast.
If you wish to become a Patreon, you can find us at www.patreon.com/MedCrimesPodcast.
If you have any crazy stories that you want us to share on our next episode of Breakroom Banter or ideas that you would love to have be covered as a case, you can send them to MedCrimes@gmail.com.
Please do. We love hearing from you guys.
Thank you for marking episode 50 with us. This is a milestone we've been looking forward to for a long time.
We're looking forward to the next 50 episodes.
Bring it.
Stay safe out there.
Bye.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring. Right.